Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is the seventh in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and your moderator. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Willie Foote. As the founder and CEO of Root Capital, Willie has been at the forefront of bringing capital to grassroots businesses in rural areas in developing countries. Mr. Foote began his career as a financial analyst at Lehman Brothers and quickly realized he needed a new career. He also was a journalist in Mexico and Argentina. He was named an Ashoka Global Fellow in 2007, a Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum in 2008, and a member of the Young Presidents Organization, YPO, in 2009. Mr. Foote holds a BA from Yale University and a Master of Science in Development Economics from the London School of Economics. Willie will speak to us for the next 30 minutes, and then while he's doing so, please write your questions and we'll engage with Q&A afterwards. Willie.
Well, good evening, and thank you to Ruth and everyone at the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to be part of this wonderful speaker series on social entrepreneurship. I must say it's a little intimidating to follow not only the footsteps of Teddy Roosevelt and Martin Luther King, but Sally Osberg of the Skoll Foundation and Bill Drayton of Ashoka and Muhammad Yunus. But, Ruth, I'll do my best. I'd like to start with a story from Tanzania, where we began. Root Capital began working in 2006. Shiahiadi Munuo is a 38-year-old farmer who was born and raised in the lush rainforests that sandwiched between the snow-capped peak of Mount Kilimanjaro and the cultivated grasslands of the savanna below. Now, that rainforest is home to elephants and leopards and about 1 million one-acre farmers, many of whom are coffee growers. Now, when I met Shiahiadi last year, she had been pruning the coffee bushes on her tiny plot. She had a machete in hand, and she had beads of sweat glistening on her forehead. And during our conversation, Shiahiadi told me how her life had changed in recent years. About 4 years ago, she and her two sons were living on $2 a day. Her children stayed home for much of the year to work on the farm, but it still wasn't enough. Market prices for coffee had plummeted, and she was considering cutting down her coffee bushes to sell the wood for charcoal. She decided to stick with coffee when a new farmer association was created in the village nearby. Hundreds of growers were organizing to collectively market their crop and hopefully tap into new markets. However, while situated in an ideal climate for growing high-quality coffee, Shiahiadi and the members of her association relied on old-fashioned equipment to home process their beans, that is, manually depulping the beans, which breaks them, results in poor quality, and prevents farmers from exporting to premium markets in North America and Europe. And now roughly 400,000 small-scale coffee growers across Tanzania still rely on home processing. So in 2006, Root Capital made a loan to Shiahiadi's association to finance the purchase of water-efficient processing equipment and a centralized milling facility. Over the next 3 years, the new equipment greatly improved the quality of their coffee, which attracted Starbucks, among others, to buy one container in the first year and dramatically more in subsequent years. Hundreds of families in the association have now benefited from access to that new market. Meanwhile, Shiahiadi doubled her income and reinvested part of her earnings, if memory serves, in 4 cows, 6 goats, and a new chicken coop in which she now runs her micro-poultry business. Perhaps most importantly, Shiahiadi's children no longer work on the farm because their mom can afford to pay for school fees, books, and uniforms. In just 3 years, Shiahiadi went from subsistence farmer to agricultural entrepreneur. And there are literally millions of people like Shiahiadi with potential to dramatically improve their standard of living, but who are locked out of opportunity due to market failures and lack of access to capital and technology and managerial talent and markets, the basic goods needed to succeed in business and lift themselves out of poverty. It's because of individuals like Shia Hyari that we started Root Capital. It's because of people like her that we continue to grow. So Root Capital is a social investment fund that I founded about 10 years ago. And our purpose is to build rural prosperity and sustain the environment in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. And of the 2.6 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, more than three-thirds of them are, three-quarters of them are in, that's a lot. More than three-quarters of them are in rural areas, and they're cut off from urban markets by poor roads that are often unpassable during the rainy season, and they lack access to basic necessities: clean water, electricity, medicine, health clinics, basic education. But if you ask them what's their number one priority, they'll typically say, I need a job, I need a stable source of income. And so Root Capital is investing in grassroots businesses that can dramatically improve livelihoods in rural communities and that can increase income and quality of life for farm households with only a few acres of land. So we're pioneering finance for small and growing businesses like a farmer cooperative, an artisan association, and a new generation of agricultural entrepreneurs. So businesses that often aggregate hundreds and sometimes thousands of farmers and artisans and can move rural populations out of poverty and become engines for sustainable development. So in places like Rwanda or Bolivia or indeed Haiti, they create alternatives to short-term survival tactics like slash-and-burn agriculture and illegal logging and fuel wood collection, all of which trigger environmental degradation and actually worsen poverty over the long term. Here's the challenge. The challenge is that those businesses are stuck in the missing middle between microfinance and traditional banking. They're too large for the $500 loan to the street vendor or the bike mechanic, but they're still too small or seen as too risky and too remote to attract commercial financial institutions. Now, I saw this gap earlier in my career. I won't mention where I worked, but I was on Wall Street. Oh, yeah, you mentioned already. I was on Wall Street in the first half of the 90s, then had an opportunity to be a business journalist in rural Mexico, where I witnessed firsthand that capital, access to credit, was not reaching the communities who needed it most. So here's what I suppose qualifies as my light bulb story, the genesis of what became Root Capital. About a dozen years ago, I'm sitting in a vanilla field in southern Mexico. I can hear parrots squawking and the rushing of a river nearby. Many hours of travel by pickup truck has landed me in the heart of the Chimalapas jungle, which is one of Mexico's last remaining cloud forests. Underneath the jungle canopy, 100 or so vanilla growers from an association of Zoque indigenous farmers have gathered to hear their leader. He stands atop a large tree stump. We organized ourselves, he said. We kicked out the narco ranchers and took back our land and forest. The tree stump he was using as his soapbox had been cut down by marijuana growers masquerading as cattle ranchers. It hasn't been easy for us, he continued, but we're organized now. We have our cooperative. We will reach the markets. We will have money for our families and for this community. And as I watched him rally the farmers, my mind turned to Manhattan. A year earlier, I'd traded my job on Wall Street for a business journalism fellowship that sent my wife and me on a two-year journey across rural Mexico. And before leaving New York City, I met with a development practitioner who'd lived for years in rural Latin America, and he said, mark my words, Willie, you will encounter leaders in very remote places who have just as much poise, sense of purpose, and leadership talent as any congressman or CEO. Sitting in the Chimalapas jungle that day, I did a mental scan of all the leaders, invariably grassroots business leaders, I had come to know across Mexico. Most lacked formal business training and many had accidentally yet passionately dedicated their lives to building competitive enterprises in the countryside. And if they could pull it off, even where drug traffickers ruled the jungle, what would keep thousands of other agricultural entrepreneurs from doing the same? In the end, sadly, the vanilla cooperative failed. Without access to credit or financial skills to manage a business it couldn't overcome, the odds stacked against it. As I traveled across rural Mexico in the ensuing months and knowing I'd soon be returning home, I started thinking about how to bridge the gap between microcredit and corporate banking so that the vanilla co-op and others like it in Mexico and beyond could build a better future. Now, I knew it was going to be an uphill battle, that building the needed market connections, for instance, might be too challenging. And yet I had seen how grassroots businesses across Mexico were starting to supply natural products to North America and to Europe. Yet 10 years later, the good news is that there are lots of companies that are craving products from farmers like Shiahiadi in Tanzania. Consumers are looking for products that are sustainably grown and ethically sourced, like fair trade certified cocoa, organic cotton, natural fiber handcrafts. We now see green seals and social labels in virtually every supermarket and department store. Global demand is booming, even in the recession, for products that are good for people and good for the planet in Guatemala and Uganda. But because those businesses are stuck in that missing middle, they can't access capital to grow their operation, to invest in productive infrastructure, or merely pay the farmers on time. So they're missing out on good business opportunities and rising demand for their products. And that's where Root Capital steps in. Over the past decade, we've developed a three-pronged strategy, finance, advise, and catalyze to help fill the missing middle in rural financial markets. So first, finance. Provide capital to businesses that are locked out of the banking system for lack of traditional collateral and other constraints. Second, advise to build local capacity and talent through financial education and training so folks with little to no formal education can better compete in world markets. So think of it as a nascent MBA in finance for rural business leaders. And third, catalyze. So we aim to spur the development of a whole new industry to fill the missing middle by crowding in local financial institutions and encouraging them to recognize market opportunities in the countryside and adopt and enhance our work and thus kickstart private markets. So let me focus for just a minute on our lending, through which we enable businesses to scale quickly and in doing so transform rural communities. An example from South America. Quinacho is a cooperative of 550 cocoa farmers located in a region of northern Peru mired in a struggle against drug production. In 2006, no local financial institution would finance them, but we did. That year, we made a $50,000 loan to the co-op to purchase, process, and export high-quality cocoa to Europe. 4 years later, Quinacho's revenues had soared to $4 million, and our loan had grown to $1 million, and the co-op is also accessing now several other sources of financing. Meanwhile, farmer income grew to $7,000 per capita, a legitimate alternative to the drug trade. Now, Quinacho is representative of the challenges faced by most of our clients and how we get around them. There are a number of good reasons why local banks didn't want to lend to Quinacho. First, it's located in an unstable region that's prone to violence and roadblocks. Not ideal for a business that needs to transport its product from the mountains down to the port. Second, the cooperative is located. It's a seven-hour drive from the regional capital where all the banks are. That's a big effort for a loan officer when less risky businesses are down the street and you can stop at Starbucks on your way home. Third, it has little in the way of traditional collateral to offer. Fourth, it's an agricultural business, and many banks are simply afraid to lend in agriculture because of both real and perceived risks. And finally, the cooperative's manager didn't study at one of the country's elite universities and therefore can't call in a favor from a friend. So why and how did we make the loan? Well, our proven investment officer, Daniel Rivera, traveled by bus, spent the entire day with the board of directors and the cooperative manager. He saw in Kinacho what we see in scores of grassroots businesses across Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa: committed membership, trustworthy leadership, and market demand for high-quality product. Kinacho's buyers in Europe wanted a reliable supply of cocoa and were eager to work with us. Their purchase agreement with Kinacho would, in effect, replace the need for traditional collateral, as it represents a discrete future revenue stream pledged to repay our loan. When the product shipped, the buyer repaid Root Capital the principal and interest owed. And we've employed that triangulation model on hundreds of loans with over 100 buyers, ranging from specialty importers to global buyers such as Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, Starbucks, Home Depot, and Whole Foods. Now, as in the case of Kinacho, most of our loans support working capital needs, in particular the cash that small and growing businesses need to pay the farmers or artisans on time. We also issue loans for long-term investments in equipment and productive infrastructure, such as the loan to Shiahiati's Coffee Association for purchase of the milling equipment, which increases quality and reduces water usage, I should add, by 80%. Now, we made our very first loan back in 1999, $50,000, to a cardamom cooperative in Guatemala. But first, of course, we had to raise the capital for it. So I rolled up my sleeves and managed to borrow $25,000, $50,000 from religious investors like the Sisters of the Sorrowful Mother from my hometown of St. Louis, and angel investors in the Boston area where I live now. I remember taking one potential investor and his family to southern Costa Rica and going on a hike into cocoa country. His kids happened to wear sandals that day, and along the path I remember spotting about 5 poisonous snakes. The sisters must have been praying for us, for had the kids been bitten, Root Capital wouldn't be here today. It's also a bit of a running joke in our office that I like to sing and play the guitar to welcome new colleagues or celebrate an accomplishment, and I must say it sometimes helps on the fundraising as well. Once I was with Green Mountain Coffee Roasters in Rwanda, courting the company to become a corporate partner and make an investment in Root. We were in the back country, traveling with Rwanda's Minister of Agriculture, who was there to schmooze Green Mountain's coffee buyer, not me. It turns out some of the farmers we visited had Nicaraguan flag pins on their lapels, thanks to an exchange program they'd been on to learn how Central American coffee farmers organize themselves. Someone mentioned that I play lots of Nicaraguan revolutionary folk songs, and the next thing I know, the TV cameras are rolling, and I'm playing the guitar and singing Pobre La Maria beside the minister and with the drum team behind me. And the next day in Kigali, a stranger runs up to me on the street and says, "I saw you on national television yesterday." So that's my 15 seconds of fame, and Green Mountain ended up investing. So, hey, whatever it takes, right? We've come a long way. This year we'll make over 200 loans totaling $75 million. In credit to small and growing businesses representing over 250,000 farm households. And over the past 10 years, we've made 850 loans totaling $240,000 in credit, and we maintain a 99% repayment rate from our borrowers and 100% repayment rate to our investors. And yet, I should highlight, the more lending we've done over the years, the more we've recognized that capital is not enough, that rural businesses often lack the technical skills to manage and grow their businesses efficiently. In response, we've developed financial training focused on bookkeeping, financial management, inventory management, basic skills that prepare a business to access credit from Root Capital or local financial institutions. And this pairing of capital and capacity enables us to reach more businesses at an earlier stage in their development. One such business is ACPCU. It's a cooperative located in southwestern Uganda that represents 3,700 coffee farmers. For years, the cooperative sold at very low prices to local middlemen, largely because they lacked direct access to financing. In 2008, they approached Root Capital for a loan. At that time, the co-op had a three-person staff and an entirely manual accounting system. And our Ugandan investment officer based in Kampala, Richard Tugume, was concerned about the co-op's ability to manage the loan and the cash flow. Rather than walk away from the need, Richard spent 5 days on site with the co-op staff, training them on how to reconcile accounts, how to do stocks management, and how to create and maintain reliable cash flow statements. Several months later, we approved a loan of $113,000, which financed their first direct exports ever and generated $450,000 in revenue for the business. A year later, ACPCU had repaid the loan, hired a qualified financial accountant, purchased computers from its profits, and taken out a new loan. Now, last year, the co-op sales more than tripled. And ACPCU has a long way to go, but there's a real sense of possibility in the organization. As the co-op manager summed up in a letter to us, he wrote, "The loan that Root Capital extended to us marked the turning point in ACPCU." And so, every loan we make or business we train brings us closer to our objective, but ultimately we're looking to have impact at scale. And part of that will be scaling Root Capital as a direct provider of capital, of financial training. But an even bigger part of that impact is the catalyzed piece of our mission, spurring other actors to begin addressing the missing middle. And beyond our direct lending and financial training, we seek to do for the missing middle what Muhammad Yunus and company did for microfinance, to build a global movement for financial inclusion, to catalyze a new asset class that unlocks billions of dollars to build better livelihoods through small and growing businesses worldwide. And one of our proudest achievements is on that front is being a founding board member of the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs, or ANDE, which was launched in 2008, has quickly become the leader in building the industry infrastructure that will enable small and growing businesses to thrive in developing countries. And we're also a founding member of the Global Impact Investing Network, or GIIN, which convenes investors such as J.P. Morgan and TIA CREF on the one hand, and practitioners like Acumen Fund and Ian Co. and the Calvert Social Investment Foundation on the other, all united behind a common belief that capital is a critical tool for solving the world's social and environmental challenges. Through ANDE and GIIN and SOCAP and so many other alliances that have emerged in recent years, would-be competitors come together to forge collaboration, a unified voice, common metrics, an advocacy platform to be much greater than the sum of the parts. And alone, we may be a drop in the bucket, but together, we're powerful. Now, in closing, as I mentioned earlier, music is a big deal for me personally, and also for Root Capital's organizational culture. I found in communities from Guatemala to Liberia and Rwanda that there are few things you can do to connect people more directly and build bonds more quickly than singing together. And I don't have my guitar with me, and I'm not going to sing, so don't worry. But I'd like to close by telling a story about music. It was about 2 years ago, and I was traveling in northern Nicaragua in the jungles with colleagues. We'd spent almost all day with farmer cooperatives, and we were pretty much ready to call it a day when the co-op manager we were traveling with said, "No, we've got to take one more stop." And so we got back in the truck, and we went over the potholes and through the mud and into the forest, and we came to a warehouse on the side of a mountain. And so we jumped. By this time, it was pouring rain. Forgot to mention it was raining. It was pouring rain, and we sprinted out of the truck to take shelter under the eaves of the warehouse. And I was pretty exhausted and not that psyched about going and seeing yet another coffee milling facility. So I opened the door, and I walk in, and there are 25 children, ages 5 to 12, with the most beaten-up horns, trumpets, and trombones you've ever seen. And there is the music teacher at the front of the class, and he raises his arms, and the kids begin to play Jingle Bells. And meanwhile, I look out the window of the warehouse, and there in the downpour, I see the proud, smiling faces of 24 beaming parents, parents who took part of their price premium from sales of specialty coffee to pay for a music teacher to come from the nearest town 2 hours away to teach their children how to play in the brass ensemble. And the future of those children and their hopes and their dreams depends in large measure on the success of their parents' business, which is why we feel this great sense of urgency to try to harness all the support and muster that's needed to provide capital and knowledge and markets so those businesses can succeed. So thank you very much, and I look forward to the Q&A.
So you're going to stay up there. Our thanks to Willie Foote, an outstanding social entrepreneur who's helped change the lives of farmers and communities around the world. Now we're going to get into the questions. So before we, before the program started, Willie asked me how, what kinds of questions this group would ask, and I said it's a pretty sophisticated audience, and now I know how sophisticated this group is. Most of the questions are about Root Capital itself and the business model that you employ. There's also a number of questions about finance and banking more generally, and then some larger social entrepreneur innovation questions. So let's talk about Root Capital first. I'm facing away from the microphone. That's bad. Okay. Let me ask you, is Root Capital a for-profit endeavor?
No. Root Capital is now housed within a 501c3. And we have a spread business within us that is our social bank, if you will, where we, over time, will spin out for-profit funds or, indeed, for-profit banks in country. But given the depth of the market failure that we've chosen to address and the need to raise philanthropic first-loss capital and cover operating deficits in the early years as we try to prove the business case for lending to these otherwise unbankable businesses, we felt that it was important to start potentially hit the wall of if we set up as a for-profit and we haven't been able to throw off the profits that we need in time that we didn't want to abandon the mission. So we're a 501c3. It's all mushed together, and yet we're pretty darn good at making sure that we separate the wheat from the chaff and we don't have commingling of funds, et cetera. But I'll repeat, over time, the view is that we will spin out into for-profit entities for the lending. Lastly, for the public goods that we deliver, i.e. financial education, financial literacy training, and the field building, the think tank within us, the mouthpiece for building the industry, that will most likely forever be philanthropically funded and stay within the NGO.
Okay. That is a very good answer, and even answered the next question that I had. So there's a number of people who want to know why you can't do the work that you do in urban areas as well as rural areas.
Well, I guess two things. One, we actually do work in urban areas in so much as often where the rubber meets the road for exporting shea butter from Ghana is the agricultural entrepreneur who set up all the infrastructure is actually in the urban areas. But the farmers, the producers, the populations that we're targeting are in the rural areas. So that's just, it's a bit of a false dichotomy that what we do isn't at all urban. But the better answer, the more important answer is I feel very strongly that what drives competition and innovation in a capitalist system is specialization. And given scarce resources, our mojo, our core competency lies in agriculture in rural areas, and we want to let 1,000 flowers bloom by being complementary to all sorts of other interventions. And there are a lot of folks who are focused on urban. There are very few folks who are focused on rural financial markets, including, by the way, 95% of microfinance is an urban or peri-urban phenomenon. So if you can come up with creative, disruptive ways to break into rural finance, you have an enormous knock-on effect in development finance.
When you talk about these farmer cooperatives, Willie, it sounds like you go to a place and there is an existing cooperative. Is that the case, that the cooperative has already been in existence? And if so, what were the benefits that caused those farmers to create a cooperative in the first place? Or do you find that you need to, in effect, gather them together into a cooperative?
That's a great question. So, again, we aren't trying to be a jack of all trades and all things to all people. So we're not in the business of creating cooperatives, pumping and priming supply and production. We look for businesses that are where their major constraint to growth is access to capital, to the financial education. So that's a piece of it, is we're not looking for the businesses that haven't been formed, because that would be a misallocation of what our strategy is and what our scarce resource can be applied for. What I will say, however, is in places like Latin America, many countries in Latin America and certain industries in Latin America, and much less so in Africa, you have a long tradition of co-ops, of social infrastructure in the countryside, where farmers have done what? Basically said, I am utterly uncompetitive as an atomized single farmer with a cash crop. I need to do what? I have to organize myself. I have to aggregate my production in order to increase negotiating power, in order to leapfrog local middlemen and sell my goods further down the market chain. If you don't, you simply should get out of most of those crops. And so you see that emerging. And so in Guatemala and Peru and Bolivia, there's this kind of a robust co-op structure now. Do they have a lot of hair on them? Yes. Have they collapsed? Have they been corrupt? Have they been inefficient? Yes, but it's there. In much of Africa, and in many industries in Latin America as well, you don't have that social infrastructure in the countryside. So what we see a lot more of are actually startup businesses, where you have an agricultural entrepreneur that's coming in and saying, okay, I'm going to disrupt this supply chain. I'm going to do, as a woman entrepreneur working with in Ghana, who's doing dried mango and dried pineapple and other things. So I'm going to create this business. And I will create a whole new market for these farmers, and I will organize the farmers under the auspices of this for-profit company. And little by little over time, that creates the enabling conditions to organize the farmers themselves into associations and cooperatives, et cetera.
So you're, in effect, funding the middleman in that case.
The benevolent middleman, absolutely. Middlemen play a very important role. We could not function as an economy without some level of intermediation.
Right.
You just don't want 10 levels.
Right.
You want one or two and not 15 that siphons all the profits away from the farmers.
No, it is true that term has taken on somewhat of a derogatory tone, but it's a necessary component.
Yeah. Well, Root Capital is clearly a middleman between impact investors and the clients and businesses on the ground. So I'd like to think we're somewhat benevolent.
All right. Well, we have to get some of your customers in here to say. why do you think you've had such an extraordinary repayment rate?
Maybe because we haven't taken enough risk, a couple of board members would argue. And I'll come back to that, because we're taking a lot more risk on some other things right now. I would say because we've been hugely disciplined and smart about our risk mitigation strategy early on, knowing that if we suffered serious losses, it would bring the whole thing down, that we can't actually afford to not have a strong repayment rate if our whole theory of change is about proving the business case to local financial institutions or to the capital markets. Then we have to do so in a way that would make sense to banks and other players in the space. So we've, as I mentioned, the triangulation and lending, where in the absence of hard assets the bank looks for, we use purchase orders and forward contracts and cash flow as the repayment mechanism. You get really good at what? Understanding what the heck can go wrong in the mango industry in Peru. What can possibly happen between farm gate and port? And once you get to know that, and you hire local people, rock and roll investment officer, either coming out of local banks or coming out of, in many cases, the finance function of the farmer cooperatives, and nobody can pull the wool over their eyes about the triple books that some of these businesses might keep, et cetera, you can mitigate your risk pretty darn well based on what? Production risk. As long as the product ships, you get paid back. Now, having said that, going back to risk and have we taken enough or not, one of our critical objectives as a social enterprise is to not, how to move beyond the original innovation upon which you were founded, to become an innovation-driven enterprise. In our case, the original innovation is basically trade finance in the sustainable natural product industry. We've recently, actually this summer, launched what's called Root Lab, which is a way for us to dial up the R&D and have an innovation fund which can push the risk frontier out into new markets and basically move into adjacent markets by leveraging our core competency in value chain finance and cash flow lending to do what? Not just do cocoa, coffee, mango, the 25-plus natural products we finance, but move into food security and nutrition. Seed companies, agriprocessors, producers of millet and sorghum and local millers of fortified flour, producers of plumpy nut, ready-to-use therapeutic foods for severe acute malnutrition. And so we just, the last month, have made two loans to seed companies in Africa, one just as an example called Tan Seed in Tanzania. $150,000 loan so a local Tanzanian company could buy 300 metric tons of seed, of hybrid, high-yielding, drought-resistant maize seed, to then turn around and sell it through an agro dealer network to 60,000 one-acre farmers across Tanzania and increase their yields for their maize by 4 to 8x. So that's a whole new realm for us, but we're still leveraging our expertise in the value chain cash flow lending. Sorry, that was a long answer.
That's all right. We have the time. So I worked with a farmers cooperative many years ago in the Philippines, and one of the greatest challenges was ensuring the quality of the product. You must encounter that all the time. You are selling high-end goods. How do you ensure the quality?
There's a whole ecosystem of, when it comes to high-end goods, exports of specialty specialty cashews or coffee or sesame. There's a whole ecosystem of actors that have evolved and emerged around those kinds of value chains where certified organic agencies, local technical assistance providers that are helping out on agricultural training, buyers in particular who are searching every mountain and hill for the right flavor profile and the right story for the chocolate that they want from the Ivory Coast. Those buyers, those technical assistance providers, those certifiers, and of course, and most importantly, the farmers themselves know that it's all about quality. That you can't sell, for instance, fair trade coffee based on, I feel guilty because I'm rich, I'm going to pay more because they're poor. That doesn't work in the market. It has to be about quality. So that's kind of the lodestar across that whole ecosystem of actors. And we don't pretend to play a role in the quality in terms of the technical assistance, but what we do is allow them to have the capital to invest in the infrastructure that allows them to have the quality, like Shia Hyati's coffee depulping machinery, and to be able to pay the farmers on time. So, for instance, if it's coffee, they're not going and picking at one moment because that's the only they can only afford to hire that labor one day or that one week, but they pick it over 3 months, and they get it just when the quality is just right. So it's kind of, how do you figure out how to be the other side of the Velcro for lots of other actors in the system and all together kind of be greater than the sum of the parts and most importantly allow that quality to meet the specs of the market timely, complete, and that's when things really start to get exciting.
But the risk that you take is that your hope is that's all going to come together and be the greater sum than its parts.
Right.
And that cooperative is going to be able to produce the quality once you give it the right technology.
Right. And so are we taking that? Are we just going on faith and a wing and a prayer?
Right.
No. So we have a whole monitoring team, and this is part of what we're trying to develop so that it can be replicable formula for banks, a monitoring team that knows when there are quality issues that show up earlier in the harvest, that a container gets rejected by Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, we might accelerate payment on the containers that we've financed. Going out and seeing what are the levels of inventory in the warehouses to see whether the product's coming in as it should or whether it's been rejected even at the warehouse gate. There's all sorts of ways for us to have predictive information as to whether the quality is going to be there and they're going to perform on their contract.
So there is a question about criteria you use for your customers. Obviously, that's one of them, predictive information regarding quality. What are the other criteria?
Well, the management and our faith in the trustworthiness of the management is a huge one. Mm-hmm. The loyalty of the membership to the enterprise. Often if you have members who've only been around for a year or two, you need to look really closely at whether if something happens and there's a little bit of pressure on the price goes up and they want to sell to the middleman because they get a better price. If they've only been around for a year or so on average, then that's trouble. Their financials. As I mentioned with ACPCU, if they can't put together a cash flow or income statement or balance sheet and can't put their application together, then you need to look long and hard at whether they've got the operational ability to perform on the contract, even though their numbers look terrible. Mm-hmm. So that's why the public good of financial education and pre-investment technical assistance allows you to work with groups that you wouldn't be able to work with otherwise. Understanding the industry. You know, we do lots of market research and embed tightly into the value chains and the related actors in 25 different agricultural products. And I should mention also a bit of forestry, a bit of apparel, a bit of artisan sector. And so you get a lot of information from the buyers and the technical assistance providers and the certifiers as to what constitutes, a strong business in their industry and what are all the telltale signs we should look for.
So it sounds like you must really have some very able people out in the field making these decisions and making these assessments. And you said that a lot of them come from either local banks or the cooperative, the financial part of the what kind of training do you put these people through in order for them to become a root capital person?
It's a great question. So you hit upon one of the greatest challenges. Starting out with root capital, you think that, you're so brilliant because you've identified the problem and you've come up with maybe a potential solution. Well, the easy thing is identifying the problem. Harder is to come up with a solution. Hardest by far is building the organization. And within that, finding the talent. Mm-hmm. And finding talent that one of our company, it's kind of cheeky, but our core company values is multilingual on boardrooms and in back roads and beat up buses. And to find that talent that not only has the hard skills, the MBA skills, but also has deep social and environmental commitments is not easy. And I'd say we've learned the hard way in some cases where it's easier to train on the hard skills than it is on empathy and values and passion and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's the most difficult thing I would say is finding that talent. Once we find them, it's very much a work in progress, but we have a whole performance management system in place, and there's actually valuation for investment officer valuation trainings that they go through ANDE, mm-hmm. the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. We're developing a knowledge management platform where Latin American and African investment officers and monitors can trade best practices on how they're look. We've developed an obligor scorecard and a credit risk rating system that is quite sophisticated and looks and feels like what a bank would want to see, and training them up on how to use all those tools as part of it. But I have to say the hardest thing is the more intangible side of finding people who've got those skills but who are truly multilingual and are going to be committed even though they're not making the kind of money that they might make with the bank or at Lehman Brothers.
Well, they wouldn't be making any money.
That's right.
In fact, there's a whole cadre of people who
That's
would
right.
love to talk to you.
A lot of talent.
Okay. This is you're in Northern California, which of course we are, the place of California cuisine and natural food and organic everything and localvores and all of that good stuff. The fair trade aspect in terms of workplace conditions and how you treat your employees and the money that gets put back to the farmer versus organic versus natural versus sustainable. There's a lot of words out there and trends and characteristics. Is it all of the above? Do you, in order for your farmers to meet your criteria, must they be sustainable? Must they be organic? How must they prove their environmental commitment? So
it's a great question. It depends on the industry, mm-hmm. in many respects. If it's coffee, For instance, we have a higher standard in terms of that it doesn't have to be fair trade, but there has to be some type of real validation that these are best-in-class farmer organizations that are both on the social and the environmental side are doing their best. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we don't want to ghettoize ourselves, not to put it negatively, but right. into just the platinum or the gold standard organizations, because if so, you're just creaming, you're just kind of doing trophy lending. Yeah. So, even in coffee and cocoa, there are a lot of organizations, let's say in the Ivory Coast, who aren't fair trade certified yet, and they may never go organic because there's just been the expectations on yield are so high locally that it would just be kind of death for the organization if they went to organic. We are holistic about it. We're agnostic. We want to keep our eyes wide open and use as much barefoot empirical research as possible. Mm-hmm. And, of course, leverage the third-party validations of the social and environmental claims wherever we can, i.e. fair trade and certified organic and so on. Mm-hmm. About 60% of what we do is fair trade certified. Mm-hmm. But maybe in stark contrast, there are many industries where you just can't do it organic. I mean, a kind of a striking example would be seeds. What Africa needs for basic grain production more than anything is fertilizer.
Right.
And we're not going to get necessarily a fair trade certified miller who is fortifying with micronutrients that flour that's going to have a bigger impact on food security than any cash crop that's being exported to high-value markets. Not mm-hmm. that that's not an incredibly important thing to do for livelihoods mm-hmm. and sustainability, but we want to be able to take what we do well, which is value chain finance and understanding these different industries, and be agnostic and smart and realistic and kind of practical believer, trust and verify, as we go through that, but do it also at the lowest cost possible. And the truth is, when you've got a whole robust chain of custody audit in place, you know, for fair trade bananas,
right.
That saves a lot of expense for us because we can pretty much rely on that being in right. place. Now, we don't entirely rely on it either. But so I don't know if that answers your question. It's kind of we want to play along the continuum, but within certain parameters, and we're not going to be financing businesses that are using, you know, the dirty dozen or doing damage.
Right.
But if it's still early days and they're headed in the right direction, then we want to take a bet on those folks.
Well, that was a great answer. So I mentioned that our next speaker is Premal Shah of Kiva, and there's a number of questions about the role of technology in terms of your funding base, i.e., could you do something like Kiva does to get more donors, and also the role of technology in managing your supply chain and how important that is.
Yeah, great question. So we are very much perhaps a bloated reflection of the broken social capital marketplace in terms of having to hunt and peck and hunt and peck to raise our capital. And we do not have a successful grassroots funder mechanism like Akiva.
Mm-hmm.
What we do have is about 90 plus, close to 100 debt holders, investors in us, who take about a 2 to 2.5% coupon and get paid back.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a fixed income instrument. But it has been, you know, death by 1,000 paper cuts to find them. And then we have probably 40 donors. And they're largely high net worth individuals, foundations, corporate partners. Our biggest investor on the corporate side is Starbucks, which is interesting. Starbucks has invested in supply chain security
mm-hmm.
Through us, both mm-hmm. on the Green Mountain Coffee Roasters is our biggest donor on our financial literacy training. How interesting. A corporate partner is funding that public good of financial education for their suppliers. But it's largely the big impact investor kind of players, the Skoll Foundations, Gates, the ultra high net worth individuals, the hedge fund managers. But we would love to over time see whether, and I've spoken to Matt and to Prem about could we say instead of taking a mugshot of all 7,000 cocoa farmers we're financing in Uganda, or actually better yet, 32,000 cotton growers in Gulu in northern Uganda we funded 3 weeks ago in former Lord's Resistance Army territory. Instead of instead of taking a mugshot of all of them, what if we did 5 or 15 and we put that up to bid on
a
Kiva site?
Right.
And they're like, nah, we can't go there quite yet. So there's clearly something there that we would like to use over time, but we're not there. On the technology side, with respect to our operations on the ground, huge efficiencies for us to leverage going forward. We've built, for instance, a proprietary loan collections system, kind of a software system that helps us to manage the very intense transactional work on the receivables financing with thousands of contracts, you know, being pledged as collateral, et cetera. But what we'd like to do is have just kind of a seamless technology platform where all of our loan applications are coming up through a website portal that we're able to do, you know, as I said, the nascent MBA in finance, and for real business leaders where you're actually using a combination of online and you can do your homework and download your curriculum, et cetera, in northern Guatemala based on a website platform like that. But we're kind of little by little right now. We're largely focused technology-wise on business process,
right,
not so much on a kind of a seamless interface with our clients.
So there's a question about real success stories in terms of graduates of yours or lendees of yours that have, in effect, made it. And you touched on that and your stories. But I suppose real success means getting Walmart or somebody else or Procter & Gamble or Safeway to buy your goods. And do you tend to be reactive, companies coming to you and saying, we've heard about you and this is how it could work? Or do you approach companies who haven't done this yet and say, let us help you stretch your mind around this concept?
A little bit of both. I'd say more the latter. There are very few trade shows that we don't hit in sustainable natural products and in forestry and so on. So we get to know most of the who's list of those buyers. As I said, we work with over 100 wholesalers, retailers, importers of natural products. Again, we are agnostic as to whether they're a big, huge Whole Foods or Home Depot, where we're financing, you know, Forestry Stewardship Council, FSC certified garden furniture from indigenous communities in Bolivia, and we're lending against contracts with Home Depot, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. But there's also a huge universe of very small mom-and-pop shops out there who play just as important a role in creating market demand and kind of niche demand for a lot of these products. And I'd argue the vast majority of the folks we work with are those smaller businesses.
Although for a small company, the transaction costs in finding each of those is...
That's right, which is why all the more reason they need organizations like Root Capital, who actually have networks and are working. We'll work with, you know, 213 businesses this year, so we can help to make some of those market connections. Now, in terms of businesses that may have not have thought about it that much, an interesting little piece of news. We are closing right now on $1 million loan, a zero coupon 5-year loan from General Mills. How interesting.
Really?
General Mills has what's called a technical philanthropy strategy right now, where they're going to work over the next decade with over 100 agriprocessors across sub-Saharan Africa who are working in food security. And so they say, okay, we've got like 250 food science PhDs in our R&D shop in Minneapolis, and we're giving away thousands and thousands of man and woman hours and technical assistance to agroprocessors across, because how do you jigger your assembly line to save $250,000 as a Tanzanian agroprocessor this year? Which model of extruder, you know, do you invest in? And, you know, hello, as they went on this journey, they're like, wait, these mom and pop shops are totally unbankable. What do we do? We're like,
right.
Let's talk. And so we've financed three agriprocessors in the last few months with money from General Mills.
That's great. Now, today's a really big day for you. You are having the great honor and opportunity to speak at the Commonwealth Club. And you got a big grant to do some work in Haiti. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure, I'd love to. Is that a plant? Haiti.
For us, yeah.
Haiti's very exciting in terms of, we all know the devastating news that just kind of comes like an abundance of insults to the country. The cholera epidemic of late, obviously the earthquake. But we are now working in Haiti, and just this week sent out a press release. We got $1 million investment from the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund, $600,000 program at investment and $400,000 first loss philanthropic capital to write down the risk on our growing portfolio there. And we were very hesitant in the initial months after the earthquake to, if you will, participate in what felt a little bit like a predatory NGO kind of arrival, where there's just lots and lots of money, I think $5.3 billion, with very little of it even dispersed to this day. But got into the early summer, and there really was a sense that we work in the Dominican Republic, we work in 15 Latin American countries, and there's a very important strategic window or lens, which is to what extent and how quickly can a value chain solution, like what we do, be relevant in both a post-conflict and a post-disaster situation? How quickly can you help to kickstart economic activity after an earthquake like that through the work that we're doing? And so we're now working with the mango sector and the coffee sector. We approved a $200,000 loan 2 days ago for a coffee farmer cooperative down in Chot in the southeast. And we're working in the artisan sector. And just a really interesting little anecdote. I was in Haiti in August. I'm going back in about a month. We drove from Port-au-Prince through beautiful but totally denuded mountains down to the town of Jacmel on the southern coast, which is about 3 hours south. And Jacmel has been the epicenter of papier-mâché production in Haiti. And it was just leveled by the earthquake, much like Port-au-Prince, and most of the ateliers, the workshops, collapsed. And many artisans died in Jacmel. And yet, there they were, 100-plus artisans working overtime to deliver on the biggest purchase order they've ever had with Macy's for not, you know, handcrafts, undifferentiated tchotchkes that only German backpackers on vacation buy, but for high-value home decor, going to Macy's, and now, hopefully, if they ink it, with Anthropology. And so we're helping to finance that production. And these artisans were, you know, giddy. In the midst of this destruction, it was just amazing to see how excited everybody was. And I think that's the key. There's this hope and this optimism around kind of unleashing the power of enterprise, even in a devastating situation like that. And I think by the end of the year, we'll do close to $1 million, maybe by end of January, $1 million in loans in the mango, coffee, and artisan sector in Haiti. And lastly, we got funding from a Swedish billionaire, not a Kiva user, but a Swedish billionaire, to pay for a full-time investment officer in financial literacy training, who'll be a local Haitian Creole investment officer on the ground, and that'll really help us to build a business there.
Great. Okay, I have two questions about changing the marketplace. The first one has to do with the consortiums you mentioned earlier. So a reality across many industries in today's world is that former competitors are having to create alliances with each other in order to be successful. And that sounds great, but more easier said than done. So I wonder if you could just talk about these consortiums and what the challenges are in having, in effect, competitors cooperating with each other in order to change the marketplace.
You mean like, for instance, Acumen Fund and Root Capital and Ianco and others pathologically collaborating with each other?
And also, you know, the organizations that would be under the auspices of GIN
First thing I'd say is, how did we survive the Darwinian flush of 2008, 2009 when the recession hit? Mm-hmm. Really important and simple strategy within these would-be competitors.
Right.
You show me mine, and I'll show you mine. So in other words, you have already identified 5 or 10 ultra-high-net-worth individuals who've self-selected into the impact investing space.
Right.
We are a complementary play to what you do. For instance, Acumen Fund and Root Capital. Acumen Fund is a wonderful model that focuses on venture capital at the base of the pyramid. Okay, let's make 30 bets, and hopefully 2 or 5 will be like Google meets treated bed nets.
Right.
Root Capital saying, well, that's important, and we need kind of meat and potatoes, maybe kind of boring, but critical banking and off-the-shelf banking products. And those two things are very complementary, and indeed there's lots of co-investing that we're doing with Acumen and others. And if you can very clearly say, this is what we do, and this is what we don't do, this is what they do, And these are investors you should be investing across this entire space. To the extent that you become friends and you work together through these alliances, you can actually start to really understand what do you do versus what we do and how can we spin and position ourselves together strategically as part of an industry block that's going to really make a dent in the universe, and we will vastly, increase the pie for everybody. I think, honestly, personal relationships and just getting to know each other is really critical. And then more importantly, being able to say, okay, well, how do you really build a network? You need to have standard metrics over time. You need to be able to measure success quantitatively, qualitatively, and you can't just do that by managing to your marketing materials. We have to agree and subject ourselves to kind of industry embraced metrics over time. That's one of many things. You can't do that by yourself, and you can't credibly build a market unless there's some overarching, connectivity to you all. So, yeah, I mean, for us, it's been, frankly, really, really critical as if we've got finance, advise, and catalyze, and if we just did finance and advise, it's kind of nice, it's incremental good, but it's not systemic change. We do finance, advise, and catalyze, but we try to catalyze by ourselves, by just shouting louder as an individual, enter a player, no. But if you wake up one day in the Obama administration and, State Department is coming to the Andy office on DuPont Circle and saying, well, so you guys are talking about like an SBA for the Basin Imperium. Like, what up with that? Like, what are your recommendations? What are your policy recommendations? Where are the white papers? If you speak as Andy on behalf of a whole block,
right,
it's much more powerful. And we can monetize that
right, as
an organization because we're more credible because we're part of that larger process.
So when you talk about working with local financial institutions and changing the marketplace so that you provide capital to this missing middle, how do you want to see either the big international banks or the local financial institutions change and evolve?
So this has evolved a little bit, and to be honest, over the last 10 years. Our original idea was that we were going to prove the business case, and we were going to have this rush of local banks into the space,
right,
because they realize while they're just mispricing risk, they just understand it. The truth is that's a very tall order. About 15 or so percent of our portfolio has access to some level of commercial banking, and many of them didn't when we started, and now they do. But getting banks to move down market is a difficult thing. It didn't happen in microfinance.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many millions of dollars were spent, and it was not successful. But we still aspire to have those banks move down market. What I think will happen most likely over time is that we will help to spur the creation of a whole new industry of specialized financial intermediaries, local financial intermediaries, for whom in their DNA it is written, we will serve this market. Because if not, what happens is the first recession, the first economic crisis, and those banks will get out as quickly as possible. And the world can't afford that to happen because these small and growing businesses are too important in terms of job creation, economic growth, environmental sustainability. So that has very important implications for Root Capital, for instance, which is we may find that, say, in Peru, which is a very important market for us, we have more than 45 borrowers representing nearly 100,000 people or farm households, that in Peru might say, you know what, the banks aren't doing this well enough. We're going to launch Root Capital, Root South America, based in Lima. We're going to compete with everybody, and we're going to kick their butt. And that will become our for-profit. Now, it will spin out of the 509A3 based in the U.S., but that replication and then others who show up in other markets, we don't want to compete with them. We'll put equity investments potentially into them. But there are all sorts of things that we can learn from the microfinance industry that will inform how we really achieve scale over time, which is to unlock billions from local financial institutions.
Okay, so we've almost run out of time. I have one last question. And I didn't ask you a lot of the questions about social entrepreneurship and innovation. But here you are dealing with these vanilla farmers, and you decide that you're going to make this difference in the world. What's the first step you did? What did you do to put that vision into reality?
Me personally?
Yeah, you personally.
Dropped out of Harvard Business School. Really, my wife and I got in a truck. from southern Mexico, and she was at Bear Stearns, I should mention. I was at Lehman. We were in Mexico. We got in our truck. We drove to Boston to enroll in the Harvard Business School together. And I had one of those classic existential crises as I passed hundreds and hundreds of farms on our way back to the U.S. border. And I decided by the time I got to Boston that I was going to ditch business school. And I was going to take the social entrepreneurial plunge. And so that was, for me, was the critical moment where I kind of, my parents thought I was absolutely nuts and out of my mind, and I had almost no choice but to continue forward. And I mentioned that story about in Costa Rica, taking that angel investor as one of my mentors and a very important supporter from the very beginning. And we went to Costa Rica, and I got him to back me for a bit, and little by little, and hunt and peck, and roll up your sleeves, and here we are now.
Okay, well, that is a terrific way to end this program. And I want to thank Willie for it. We also want to thank our audience, both here and on the radio and on television and on the internet. Today's program has been a seventh in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.